It's 1:16. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Late start for this portion of the program today due to the press of news and weather. Well, at the turn of the 20th century, Danville, Illinois was becoming a small city. The population was growing. In the 1890s, the population doubled. Industry was thriving. Goods and people arrived and departed by rail. The city was connected by rail to big Midwestern cities, including Chicago, St. Louis, and Indianapolis. It was also a time when the city's women, like women across the country, we're stepping into public life. This afternoon, we'll talk with the authors of a history of the time that focuses on women and social reform in Danville, Illinois. Our guests are Janet Dutzman Cornelius and Martha LaFrenz Kay. They are the authors of Women of Conscience, Social Reform in Danville, Illinois, 1890 to 1930. Listeners, you're welcome to join our discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Both our guests this afternoon are retired from the faculty of Danville Area Community College. Martha LaFrenz Kay is retired from the Literature and Humanities faculty. Janet Dutzman Cornelius, who is currently an adjunct professor at Eastern Illinois University, is retired from the History faculty at DACC. She is also the author of two previous books, When I Can Read My Title Clear, Literacy, Slavery, and Religion in the Antebellum South, and Slave Missions and the Black Church in the Antebellum South. Cornelius's and Kay's book, Women of Conscience, Social Reform in Danville, Illinois, 1890 to 1930, is published by the University of South Carolina Press. Again, the phone numbers, listeners, if you'd like to join our conversation this afternoon, please do so. 333-9455, that's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, Janet Dutzman Cornelius and Martha LaFrenz Kay, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon and your patience with us in having this delayed start this afternoon. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So let's begin maybe with Janet. Both of you are joining us on the phone this afternoon, so I would like our audience to get a sense of who each of you are by the sound of your voice. So maybe we could begin with Janet. And Janet, would you first tell us a little bit about what led you to examine the entrance, you and your co-author, Martha, examine the entrance of Danville's women into public life and their contributions to the city?
Celeste, it's very good to be with you. I'm a regular listener of WILL when I'm home. I'm not home at the moment, but it's always good to hear you. When I was teaching at Danville, I also belonged to a social history club, a local history club. And one night, Sue Richter, who's the director of the Vermilion County Museum, gave a program on women's clubs at the the YWCA, and I found out that women actually reached out to upper-class women actually reached out to working-class women. They started the Y because women workers in about 1910 couldn't find a place to have lunch in downtown Danville. All the only places available were taverns, which were dirty and also not very welcoming to women. And so the fact that that women started a lunchroom and eventually a club, a boarding house, and all sorts of activities that working class women seized on was really interesting to me. And that's where I got the interest in this particular topic.
Yeah, and then, Martha, how did you come into the picture?
Well, on Janet's tailwind, I think we both retired about the same time, and I was looking for a project, and she had this one in mind, and I said, "Could I join on the bandwagon?" And she welcomed me on, and we've had a good partnership for about 10 years. The research of before this book has gone on. So we're glad to be able to talk about it as a finished product at last.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's you did a wonderful job on it. It's a good read.
Thank you. Thank you.
Janet, you mentioned, women not having a place, working women in Danville not having a place to have lunch. This was surprising to me. Early in the book, I learned that Danville had the highest percentage of working women in Illinois during this period we're talking about, 1890 to 1930.
Yes.
So give us a little picture of what was going on in Danville. How many women were in the population, and how many worked? What kind of percentage?
Okay. Women became a larger part of the labor force after 1900, but even in 1895, about 9% of the population of the women, of female population, identified themselves as paid workers. By 1920, five times as many women were on employment rolls in Danville, and they comprised 20% of the workforce. Almost a fourth of the women in Danville in 1920 worked for pay. So that was a considerable number. And all during the 1900s, Vermilion County had the highest percentage of women workers in the state of Illinois.
Yeah. What kinds of occupations did they hold, Martha?
I'll let Janet go ahead with that question.
Okay.
Okay. Surprisingly, a lot of them still kept were domestic workers and laundresses, because there were so many single men in Danville. But the largest growing, and many of them worked with their families in family businesses, some were teachers and nurses, and saleswomen was a category that grew quickly. But the largest, fastest growing were clerical jobs, which of course were begun by men, but by the 19s and 20s were dominated by women. And many women came from small towns and rural areas into Danville, into the big city of Danville, to take these kinds of jobs. That opened the door for another problem, the problem which one historian called women adrift. You come in, you don't have any place spoken for to live, you're not sure where you're going to work. And there were people in the less respectable parts of Danville who could take advantage of that.
Okay, who wants to talk about that?
Go
Sin
ahead,
City.
You get started, Martha.
Well, we took the title for one of our chapters from Bobby Short's book. Bobby Short grew up in Danville, and he wrote a wonderful book called Black and White Baby about his early years in Danville. And he used the term Sin City to describe parts of the town where he sometimes worked, because he played the piano in saloons even as a youngster. So Sin City was something he saw up close and personal, and we borrowed that term. And so one of our chapters is called Sin City because of the proliferation of gambling, alcohol, and prostitution, which really was rife and made Danville's reputation right up until the 50s, 1950s actually. Danville was known as a Sin City.
Yeah. There were brothels. But
oh, yes.
There were also entertainments. There were bars. Mm-hmm. And Sin City attracted, among others, college men from Urbana.
That's right.
Yes, when we tell our students today that people from Champaign-Urbana used to come to Danville to have fun, they can't believe it.
So now, this was, for some women, this was a place where they could find employment singing. Or, as Bobby Short wrote about, the girls who would draw folks in to play a game, a dice game called 26.
That's right.
26 girls. So that's one thing. But on the other hand, there were women forced into prostitution.
That's right. This period of time, the 19s, early 1900s, is often considered the time of the white slave scare. It was progressive people who wanted to reform were also caught up in the plight of women who were came to places, for example, came from Europe into the United States, didn't speak the language, and were forced into prostitution. But there were also, statistically, there were actually more citizens of the U.S. who were forced into prostitution. And even in Danville, we found some evidences of those. This was a time when the Mann Act was passed in Illinois, which or by an Illinois congressman, a federal law, which forbade people taking women across state lines for immoral purposes. And we did find some evidence of some of these incidents in Danville. There was a lot of money to be made out of prostitution. Therefore, it was not just a joke or a made-up scare. There really was some forcible prostitution.
Yeah. So what role did women as civic activists play in progressive reform in this movement to keep women from going adrift?
Well, that's the question of the book. What role did women play, and what growing role did they play? And we really don't focus the book on prostitution.
Right.
Because, as you can imagine, the records are very slim. The prostitutes didn't leave us minutes of their meetings or diaries. There are court records, and there were some interviews that took us back to the days of the when prostitution was still alive, but mostly what we had to work with led us to examine progressive women who were intent on doing things for women and children that were not necessarily prostitutes, but for orphans and for people who needed help with health-related matters and homemaking matters. This book really examines the journey of women from the privacy of their homes. Now, I'm talking now about well-off women of the upper and upper middle class who didn't have to leave home, but who were beginning to feel a need in the community, and so they began to leave their homes to do good for others, and thus the title, Social Reform. The first step they generally took was to go out into their churches and start their sewing circles and raising money and doing things for the church just internally and still pretty privately. But after they gained some confidence, so this is back in the early part of the movement, 1890s, after they gained some confidence in what they could achieve, they began to look out into the community in a wider way and began to form clubs and began to form organizations which did things for women and children. In this community, most notably the Children's Home, the Women's Club, and the YWCA, which Jan has already talked about.
Yeah, and it was women who established and managed the orphanage in the county.
Yes, and quite a remarkable feat. They did it without the leadership of men. Now, many of the board ladies, as that chapter is entitled, many of the board ladies had husbands with rich checkbooks, and they contributed generously. But the women themselves had the vision, made the plans, made a few mistakes, corrected their mistakes, and built on that, and opened what was in the beginning a very small private home to orphans that they perceived were in the poorhouse, and grew rapidly so that expansion after expansion was necessary. And they micromanaged the thing right up until the 1960s when the state finally said, we think we better take over here. It was a wonderful growing, learning experience for women and gave them lots of confidence to see even bigger problems and affect even bigger solutions.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guests this afternoon, Janet Dutzman Cornelius and Martha LaFrenz-Kay. They are the authors of Women of Conscience, Social Reform in Danville, Illinois, 1890 to 1930. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in the nearby Danville community of Belgium. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. I have a lot to tell you.
Okay.
I'm standing in probably in the last buildings left in that area of town that used to be used for a house of ill repute. just what was then Green Street, is now Sager, Bryant Street, College, Commercial, Washington Street. I think that makes the entire area where it mainly was at. And now, I think, I hope I'm not mistaken, but the reason College Street is called College Street is because there was a college down here. And if I remember right, the college was established way back after the Civil War, but slightly earlier than what you're talking about, and it was a finishing school for girls, if I remember right, which makes it very strange that it should end up where it is, because what happened, along came the railroads, okay? The railroads came in after that time, and that's when the demeanor of things changed quite a bit because of the excess male population and went down that road. But isn't it kind of strange that things get that sort of a strange change to it? Because why? You know, and Danville has made some strange changes like that. And like you said, the women have been progressive, but there was a finishing school here that people sent their daughters from the East Coast here, you know, because this was a very desirable place when it was first, right after the Civil War.
Go ahead, Jan. Danville... was considered a very desirable place after the Civil War, and many of Danville's leading people in the time we were looking at were Civil War veterans and came into the community to make their way and make it into a great city. And you mentioned the railroads. Danville was also a river town. And river towns traditionally had red light districts, and so this is one of the reasons. But it is ironic. There's always been a strong arts community in Danville. We mentioned at some the number of live theaters, the amount of entertainment, the fact that people could make women could make livings as elocution teachers, and during this time, shows some of the wide interests of the community. I wanted to go back, Celeste, to your question about what Danville reformers did specifically for working women who were in danger, and just mention quickly the Travelers Aid Society. Mm-hmm. And for a particular reason, Danville women reformers were strongly influenced by the Chicago Women's Club and the Chicago Social Science Club, and by Jane Addams. And when an occasion arose that one of the Danville women, Mary Giddings, had to help a friend of hers who was from Europe find his niece who had never arrived, she investigated with the help of the Hull House of the Travelers Aid Society in Chicago, and she was able to find the girl and then founded a Travelers Aid Society in Danville. And she hired hired a Hull House agent to be the first secretary for the Danville Travelers Aid Society. The secretary would meet trains and would provide help for women and eventually for men and children also. And the Travelers Aid Society endured for several decades after its start as a way to help women adrift.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call this afternoon. Yeah,
I was going to, I don't know if the caller's still on or if he's listening still probably, but he was interested in the ironic juxtaposition of the red light district with the finishing school. I don't know if we ran into the finishing school or not, but certainly St. Elizabeth's Hospital was there, and there were many important Catholic centers there. There was a Catholic school there, wasn't there, Jan, out in that part?
Yes, yes, there was.
And we interviewed several people who had memories of that area where the prostitutes were well-known, well, not well-known as friends, but were well-recognized and were treated with some respect and allowed their business to take place there on the same streets or near the same streets where very respectable people lived at the same time. It was a very thriving part of town. And, of course, the powers that be, the law enforcement, was turning its back pretty much for quite a long time on the illegal trades that were going on in that part of town. So the citizens just had to make do, and they did.
Yeah. Let's talk about some of the individual women that readers will meet in Women of Conscience.
That's our most exciting
thing
to talk about. We met some wonderful women through the records that we were studying to try to see how these institutions came about, these reformers. That was the icing on the cake for us, wasn't it, Jane?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's talk about Cora Abernathy.
Well, I discovered Cora when I was looking through the archives at St. James Methodist Church. They have a wonderful archive, and they welcomed me to spend hours and hours there. And the records of their church are very well maintained in big flat books that are under all kinds of protection so that they don't deteriorate. And I ran across an article written by Cora when she was in her 80s, I think. She was just retiring from a long, long tenure of Sunday school teaching at St. James. And she did a retrospective, which was published in the Commercial News and then cut out and put in the plat book that is part of the archive at St. James. She was just a remarkable woman who taught several different kinds of Sunday school classes for over 40 years, young men, older women. But the class that she was most proud of, and the class whose picture is on the cover of our book, she called the Searchers, young women whom she taught for the longest tenure of time. And she says they were with her through all kinds of loss in her life. She lived on Logan Street in Danville, recorded her life, her marriage, her sons, and the death of her husband and one of her sons at least. And the other one moved away, and she was living home alone when she wrote this retrospective, but still remembering very warmly her family and the Searchers, the girls of the Searchers class. Later on, Cora, who didn't really have to work for a living because her husband had a very good job, began some professional, part-time professional jobs, which meant that she was not only stepping out of her home into her church activities, but was also investigating professional possibilities. She was a truant officer, which had a very different meaning in those days. She was a census taker, and I forgot, Jan, she had another couple of jobs. Oh, she was a kind of a traveling investigator of the county jail and the county poorhouse. She would report back to the county board on the conditions that she saw there.
She also headed the employment service for the YWCA.
Right. She was one of the founders of the YWCA. She was, in many ways, a progressive woman for her time.
Yeah. Do we know what led her beyond the confines of church into the public sphere?
I don't know that we do. I'm sorry, I don't think I know the answer to that question.
Yeah. Maybe we could talk a little bit here about the shift it starts maybe a little bit with the Civil War in that women were left behind and they had to be actors.
That's right.
They had to take care of themselves and their children and others.
And that's when they learned they could do it.
Yeah. So we have a change in how women think of themselves and what they're capable of.
Absolutely.
Yes, and I think one important aspect, too, of the time we're looking at is leadership. One of the people we interviewed who was a descendant of pioneers in Danville said that the people who came to Danville after the Civil War and started things were really spirited and leaders, and they married the same kind of women. And you can see that certainly in the women we studied.
So how did men react to the changing roles, the coming political involvement of women in Danville?
We get that question a lot. Go ahead, Jan.
I noticed particularly when the Women's Club, which was not a bridge-playing social status completely type of club when it was started. It was really a progressive social reform. It had a lot of progressive social reform goals. And when the Women's Club would come to the council and ask them to pass laws, first a law to have a truant officer, a woman truant officer who could find out what the condition of kids was, why they weren't coming to school. And then then got a law passed against spitting on the sidewalk in Danville, got a law passed to collect the garbage, got a law passed to inspect grocery stores, which used to have meat out on the counter and fruit all the time. You can imagine the flies. Well, what did men do? In most cases, they passed the laws. And I think part of it was that they liked the idea of what the women were doing, but it wasn't something they were going to initiate themselves. The other factor that we can think of is that many of the men were also very socially conscious at that time. Danville was very clubby, and most of the men, the husbands of the women we profile, were also community leaders. They started the libraries, and they headed the libraries and many other aids.
Hmm. I think we didn't find that men were standing as barriers in the way of these progressive reforms. I think they, for the most part, appreciated what was happening and glad that somebody was helping out, so they didn't want to stand in the way of the women. And we have a few little stories about how men tried to slow down the women. A pastor in one of the churches went in and told the ladies that they needed to change the name of their society, which was the Pastor's Aid and Improvement Society. They needed to change the name because he didn't want the ladies improving him.
Yeah.
Well, you know, little stories like that come along. But for the most part, it seemed to be, if not a team effort, at least a cooperative effort, that men saw good coming out of the women's reform efforts.
Yeah. And
the biggest clash definitely came in the teens, when the women primarily were members of the Women's Christian Temperance Union and other anti-liquor sale movements.
Right, right.
And there were, of course, the liquor interests, primarily male. And there were several battles between the dries and the wets. First, just election battles, and then as the wets realized they might lose, a lot of bribing of voters, a lot of bribing of election officials. In 1911, a grand jury found that the election commissioner himself and several of the other members of the government had been taking bribes from the wets to try to keep Danville wet. However, unfortunately for them, women in Illinois received the vote in 1913, as early as 1913. Now, the vote for all women was of course 1919, but in 1920. But in 1913, Illinois women could vote for president or for municipal government, so they could vote for city officers,
not for state officers. Tell them why.
Yeah, because there was the word male was in the state constitution, so they could not vote in the state for state officers, but they could for all the others. And the
result of that is that we have voting records that are separate. We could tell how women voted and how men voted for a while because they had to have separate ballots.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
It was interesting.
It was a very, very important time because many of the cities in Illinois went dry after women could vote. And in Danville, there was a lot of competition. The first vote after 1913 was in 1915, and women voted strongly for temperance, for outlawing liquor sales, but not quite strongly enough to win. However, in 1917, their votes carried the day. As the newspaper said, they carried by the women, and Danville went dry. Technically, of course, by oral history, we know you could get liquor in Danville, but technically, Danville was dry from 1917 until the end of Prohibition.
Yeah, and we have to remember here that temperance and Prohibition were women's rights issues.
Absolutely. They definitely were linked. The Equal Suffrage Association in Illinois was linked. It had the same goals as the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and the two of them. Many in Danville, we found that many of the women who were leaders in one organization were also leaders in the other.
Mm. They weren't always easy bed partners, but eventually they had to join forces, right?
Exactly. There were many, of course, progressive-minded reformers and equal rights people who were not that fond of making the temperance issue so important, but they did work together.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about Danville's African-American community during this time. What were women doing in the African-American community? Because I'm sure we have a segregated town.
Yes, we do.
Were African-American women also involved in bettering themselves, in interested in sisterhood, interested, of course, they've always been, they've been described so often as the backbone of the church.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on in the African American community? Do we know very much about that?
We know a little. Because of some books written in the 20s and in the 90s, we do know something about a few of the women in Danville. They started a Colored Women's Aid Club in 1902. Colored Women's Aid Clubs were organized in several middle-sized Illinois towns and had their own Illinois Federation. The one in Danville, according to their reports, bought a house and located club rooms and a social center for the young people. This was in 1906. Then, after Laura Lee, who was a member of this Colored Women's Aid Club, joined with others and in appealing to the courts to let her take colored children and provide a home for them. The organization that Martha talked about, the children's home, did not take colored children.
Mm-hmm. Well, they took them temporarily, but they always tried to place them out, and it was Laura Lee who was set up to accept them, and so she generally ended up taking care of the African-American children.
Yeah.
Right, and they not only did that, there is today a Laura Lee Foundation and home, which is, or not home, but center, community center, and Laura Lee is very famous in the town of Danville for everything she did.
Bobby Short talks about it in his book, too, the Laura Lee home and the children who lived there at the time, and how the facility was open to the neighborhood. So he played there. He was not an orphan by any means, but he lived not far away, and he played there and felt welcome there.
Yeah.
There was also a state Illinois Federation of Colored Women's Clubs because, again, African-American women were not generally welcome in the women's club as such. So Danville had a very prominent branch of those, of that organization. In 1922, they hosted the state federation, hosted it in 1906, and served as state officers for the Illinois Federation. So they had some broader membership as well as their local membership.
Yeah. In the course of researching and writing this book, you met a woman who lived through the period, and when you interviewed her, you had to do it through written communication because she was deaf. Tell us about her and what you learned from her.
Oh, she is certainly one of my favorite people. She was, I met her the week before her 101st birthday. She was in assisted living, and she was, as you say, totally deaf. I had notified her before and wrote some questions out, which she was prepared to answer.
Mention her name, Jan.
Her name is Gladys Walker.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people in Danville remember her because she was such an energetic, active person. She was a working girl. She went through Danville High School in the teens. Her father was a fireman. She went through a high school in her teens, graduated in 1917, took the business course, immediately went to work in offices, and worked for the same company, the CNEI, in the office for 43 years. She was also, but her son, we also, Martha and I talked to her son, and he said that doing things for others was as natural as breathing to his mother, and she was always reaching out. When she was in high school, she joined the YWCA branch, high school branch, and was one of the officers there. Then she kept bringing other working girls into the YWCA. It made that really her life's work. He said that he gave me copies of her husband's diary, which he would say repeatedly, "Glad out." Gladys was out for the evening. And Wesley remembered that his father took care of him often in the evening because meeting with the women of the Y was really her passion. Mm-hmm. She became a member of the Y board. But she was still so feisty and energetic and proud of what she had done when I interviewed her and remembered the girls that she had gotten into the Y. I always remember the story of the girls who worked for one of the Five and Dimes downtown. They said that their boss wouldn't let them join the Y, and Gladys knew that he was making them eat their lunch in their restroom. You can imagine the sanitary facilities at that day. And she threatened to report him to the health department. And then he gave in and let them join. And after that, those girls were Gladys' friends and followers.
Yeah. Sadly, though, you know, she worked for the railroad for all those years, and she saw men around her get raises and promotions. And
that's right.
So,
and when we asked her son about it, he said it was never discussed, but there was something about the way his parents talked about this that he knew this was not right.
Yeah, very interesting.
And they were all aware that this was not the way things should be.
Yeah. We're out of time. I'm really sorry. We'll have to have you back on, and we can talk about some of the other women we meet in the pages of this book, including Elizabeth Stewart and Mary Forbes, also an interesting woman.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, definitely.
So, but we do have to wrap up today. My thanks to the two of you, Janet Dutzman Cornelius and Martha LaFrenz Kay. Thank you so much.
It's been our pleasure.
It has certainly been enjoyable. Thank you.
Our guests this afternoon are the authors of Women of Conscience, Social Reform in Danville, Illinois, 1890 to 1930. The book is published by the University of South Carolina Press.